Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurick, Jack Spencer, Jacob Kanzler, and our special guest this week, Abby Clark from Vanguard Public Affairs. Thanks for coming over. We appreciate it, Abby.
Thrilled to be here.
We've got a lot of things on the agenda, and the first thing we're going to talk about is the 3rd Congressional District, where James Lauer is in for the Republicans against Justin Amash, who is under some real political problems based on the polling that we had with Practical Political Consultants. And Justin Amash has got at least 2 primary opponents right now. I think the scuttle is that he's going to get more. We've heard some names floated around as possibilities. But what I wanted to talk about first was the Democrats' possibilities, and that the Democrats are starting to take a look at this 3rd Congressional District as a potential place to play. Amash is struggling in the polls, and if there is a new person who would be running on the Republican side, this would be the time to get at it, if there were any time. And so, Jacob, I wanted to ask you first, based on some historical data, how did the Democrats do last year, or in 2018, with their candidate against Justin Amash?
Well, Kathy Albrow pulled in 43% of the vote to Amash's 54%.
So what did we have last time when we had a serious candidate? Let's say, I don't know, Pat Miles. Pat Miles ran 2010. What did that look like?
Well, in 2010, we had Pat Miles, and he pulled in 37% of the vote to Justin Amash's 59.
There's one more historical number you should look at, though, because I'm curious. You know, we're looking at Amash's performance against Democrats. I want to know, of a mainstream strong Republican, when's the last time a strong Republican ran in that district, and how did they do? Maybe Romney against Obama? See what I'm getting at? That I want to see if Amash's numbers kind of match with the base of the district. And what is the base of the district? You have to look up at our electoral guide, but election guide.
Yeah, well, Jacob's looking up that number. Vern Ehlers beat the last Democrat in that district in 2008, which I think is probably the best year that they had was 2008 in the state of Michigan, and the Democrat lost 61-35. So it's not like this is strong territory. But we're hearing, Abby, that the DCCC is gearing up for a race in this district because they think that it's prime territory for a takeover. We wanted to get your thoughts on this.
My gut is that it's basically an R+10 district, at least. I mean, it is trending. Kent is trending towards Democrats. But at the same time, Calhoun's now in the district, and that's a county that used to be good for Democrats that started trending more Republican. So it's not there yet, in my view, in terms of base numbers for a Democrat to win it.
Sorry, I just want to interject here.
Oh, all right, please.
The
2016
presidential and the 2012 presidential are below the base, where you had the Republican winning 51% in 2016 and 53% in 2012, and again, the base, as we had it, was 58%.
Jack, your thoughts. Is there a chance here for Democrats?
Well, the chance for Democrats would be the scenario where Amash loses the primary, runs as a Libertarian, and sucks enough away. I don't know if that's realistic or not. The other thing to remember, I don't think Amash had any problems whatsoever until Trump. I mean, as long as the Democrats controlled the White House, I think his votes were kind of okay because of lots of no votes and everything that happens when you're a constitutional voter.
Don't you think the more likely scenario, though, is if he gets three or four primary opponents that he winds up skating through and winning anyways, and in the end he's going to wind up carrying the district because it is so strongly Republican that they're going to be like, well, it's either this guy that we're not really fond of or it's a Democrat we can't support at all.
I think if Amash makes it through the primary, it's his seat.
Yeah.
Easily. Like, to me, there's no question about that. The threat to Amash is a Republican primary, for sure. I think Lauer isn't super strong, but there's a lot of Trump support in any Republican district, and Amash can't benefit in that primary from crossover votes from Democrats because you have to pick one primary ballot or the other, and we're going to have Democrats choosing a Democratic primary ballot in a big year. So I think that if, like you said, the Republican primary field gets split more ways, that would be the best thing for Amash. Amash will make it through if it's multi-way and then probably be fine. But if it's just him in a head-to-head with a Trump supporter, that could be very difficult.
I, of course, am cynical.
No.
What a shock. I do not believe Justin Amash just went on TV and said that about Trump just because he felt like speaking his mind. I believe he thought he was in trouble with a primary, and there's some plan involved with the why he went ahead and did what he did. Now, whether just because it's a plan doesn't mean it's a good plan, but I still believe that he had reasons for doing that that had to do with him looking at his situation in the primary.
You mean trying to appeal to independents and Democrats and trying to lure them into the Republican primary to get him support?
I'm not sure how he looked at it. I have to believe he had polling that led him to, for some reason, it led him to making that decision. Who knows? Maybe he's trying to get six opponents in the Republican primary. I don't know. But I can't believe he would just go on there for the heck of it and say that.
What I was going to say is, so the line in Republican politics since 2016 is kind of, are you with the president or not? And so we have this forming in this primary with Lauer on one side and Amash on the other. So we'll kind of see how this district kind of responds, you know, if they're a Republican district that is with Trump and aligns with the president, or, you know, if they like their guy. So I think it'd be interesting to see how this plays out.
All right, we're going to have James Lauer join us here a little bit later in the podcast, and we'll ask him this and some other questions, including if he's met with the DeVos family yet. We'll get the answer to that here in just a minute. But let's touch on a few additional topics here. And, Abby, we wanted to ask you about the political fallout that Governor Gretchen Whitmer may or may not have in regards to Benton Harbor. Obviously, the amount of people who are now speaking in support of Benton Harbor and their schools seems to be growing. Does this present a problem for her?
Absolutely. It's just a really sad and awful situation across the board. And it's not just a political or fiscal situation. It's an emotional situation. It's cultural, it's racial, it's historical. So there's a lot caught up in it. And I think a lot of people's biggest frustration with Governor Snyder is he often treated people like numbers in a spreadsheet. And if you just look at the numbers in the spreadsheet on Benton Harbor High School, it has to close. The math isn't good. But these are human beings. This is a community that has borne the brunt of just a huge legacy of structural racism, frankly. And it's very difficult because where's the money? Like, if they want to keep the high school open, you know, where do you find like bailout dollars for it? So it's very, very hard. But the governor definitely needs to take the political situation and the emotional situation very seriously because there are very low levels of trust.
Well, if she thinks she's going to get money out of the legislature, that's going to be a no-go. But, Jacob, this is not a new situation, Benton Harbor. It just seems like it's come to a head now.
Yeah, well, one thing that I think is interesting is that the governor is out front on this and kind of is owning this plan, and which, you know, she probably should do. She's the leader of the state. But I would guess that this is not of her own making. Her administration has been working with Benton Harbor since before she got into office, and that it's coming to a head now is due to a variety of factors. The district has received state emergency loans, and they are now statutorily barred from borrowing anymore. You know, they've been through a partnership agreement with MDE. They have a cooperative agreement, which I think was a new thing made for them. And so the administration has been working on this for a while, and I think it's kind of coming to a head now, in addition to the fact that the school reform office and the state's authority over the district ends June 30th, thanks to some lines in the A to F bill that were added in lame duck that we are now all becoming aware of now.
Jack, any thoughts on Benton Harbor?
Well, this is at least 30 years in the making, if you really go back. The struggles there have been epic, quite frankly. And I think the governor's going to basically stick to her guns on this, that they've got to break it up and let the students go to other places and possibly get a decent education. And again, and I still think this is similar to the no fault. The time that you can do these sorts of things are early in your term. That's where you're sort of like, you know, why only Nixon could go to China. She can do some of those things as a Democratic governor now, early in the first 2 years of her term, where she won't really be able to politically later, and stop and think about how much it helps her in a certain way when you have Senator Shirky, Senate Majority Leader, come out and say, we are not going to give them the money. Well, that actually gives her even more backing on, well, the legislature's not going to help anyway. I think she's in a lot better position to do it now. And that's why I think you've seen some areas where she's been able to kind of cross more toward the middle. And she's got to do it early if she's going to do it.
Any thoughts on this, John?
She's got an opportunity to sort of test whether doing the right thing is more politically favorable than doing the political thing. Doing the political thing would be kind of ignoring this issue. This has been a district that's been mismanaged for decades. There's trails of litigation that point to that fact. Part of the problem is socioeconomic, but students in that community have been fleeing this district for years and years, which has kind of exacerbated the problem they have now. So doing the right thing is probably moving those students to another school district, closing the high school, resolving the economic problem that, you know, even Don Weatherspoon, who was here last week, said you can't fix it anymore. It's you're past that point where you can fix it. So I think she has to do something. But from a political standpoint, what's fascinating, if you think about what her tenure is looking like so far, she's already aggravated, to is probably a mild word, the trial attorneys with no-fault reform. If she does this, she's running the risk of aggravating the Benton Harbor community and perhaps even part of the Detroit community as kind of raising a racial issue. If she sits down with Enbridge, which I think she really has no choice but to do, she runs the risk of alienating the environmental community. So, and this is just the first 6-7 months of her tenure. So I think that's enough to at least make her and her people probably take a pause and think about we're ruffling some feathers. But if it's all done for the right purpose and we get good solutions out of it, is that going to weigh to her benefit politically in the end?
I think that she's kind of in the wrong place in the wrong time as far as the Benton Harbor reaction. I mean, she just happens to be in the spot right now where she's taking all the slings and arrows, but the frustrations in Benton Harbor have very little to do with her and more about the culture. I think you kind of talked about, Jack, that this has been brewing for 30, probably even longer, just the feeling of being marginalized and that this has almost become like a segregated community, that we're only in this area, nobody's respecting us, and nobody's really taking us into consideration.
Oh, it's more than almost segregated. It's one of the more segregated areas in the United States. I mean, the St. Joe Benton Harbor situation is, to read the history of it, is just crazy and very sad. But what you were saying about, she inherited this problem. I mean, She's only been in office a few months. She did not create this problem in Benton Harbor, far from it. And what's a little scary as a Democrat to see is she's going to have a lot of cleanup to do, and it reminds me of some of what Governor Granholm was stuck with after the long Engler administration. You know, a lot of chickens came home to roost from the cuts that were made, And that hurt her throughout her tenure. So I think, you know, I hope the Whitmer administration is really prepared that this is one of the first, but it certainly won't be the last legacy of former policy decisions that is going to leave her in a very difficult situation like she is now.
Actually, I think it may be the wrong situation that she didn't want to inherit, but I think she may be the right person at the right time to deal with it. And I said this last week, and I'll say it again. We talk about all these millions of dollars here and there. That's not the real cost. The cost are children that don't get educated. That it way outweighs any of the dollars and cents. I really think that she's the one who's going to take advantage of it early in her term to be able to do this and do that and so on, and understand that she can do it now. Now is the time to do these things, and I think that also applies to some of the things Dana Nessel can do early in her term. And I really think that that we're in a situation here where we're going to see some we already have seen a very interesting first 5 months. I think it's going to be a very interesting first 2 years.
Well, let's talk about that a second, and that's the last subject I wanted to broach here with you all. And Abby, Dana Nessel does have a situation here in Flint where there's some real ticked off people who think that everybody's going to get off scot-free. And she told us on Friday, no, people shouldn't rest easy. There could be some more prosecutions. Do you feel like she has to prosecute somebody in order to make good in Flint?
Oh, absolutely. And
somebody's head's got to roll.
Yeah, and I think this was, unfortunately, the communications rollout of this announcement was mishandled.
You think so?
Oh, absolutely, because people, that didn't come across to lay people, to regular people. Mm. All they saw was all the charges were dropped. And it felt, you know, there was feelings of betrayal, rage, the levels of trust amongst the Flint community, the African-American community, are already just absolutely abysmal. And for to see the charges got dropped, they, you know, people don't, we're insiders, we know about Dana Nessel. Most people in the state don't really know who she is. They have no reason to trust her. They don't know her heart. I believe her intentions are to do more and better prosecutions, but people don't know that, and this just feels like the trust is low. She's got to do something. It's going to be tough to fix.
Well, part of the problem, though, is, I mean, we've talked about these cases before, and they weren't necessarily strong cases against Nick Lyon. They weren't necessarily a strong case against Eden Wells. And you look at sort of the way it led up. I mean, what, the preliminary exam for these things were 12 months long? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just like we're trying so hard to get something to stick here. Is it possible that maybe with this extra material they found that there's just nothing there to do anything with?
It certainly is possible. I totally agree. The case on Nick Lyons, like, it's tough. I'm not a lawyer. I can't say I know, but I haven't heard that it's very strong. People need, in politically, the people of Flint need to feel that someone has been held accountable. Someone has been punished. People have died. You know, people's children were poisoned. Who is responsible? Who is being punished? And if the answer is just, oh, the case isn't strong enough, people just aren't ever going to understand that. Nessel's office or the Whitmer administration needs to demonstrate that accountability in Flint is a very high priority.
Jacob?
Yeah, short term, this isn't helpful for Dan Nessel. One, because like Abby said, you get these headlines that tell only one piece of the puzzle. If it was possible, I think it would have been great if somehow you bring that new case, that new charge at the same time. But I wish I had Lisa here because I don't think that's how it works. I'm guessing that Dana Nessel was constrained by the courts. They asked for 6 months and they got 6 weeks in some of those cases. And so I'm guessing that's kind of the intent, is that they discovered we have all this stuff here that we feel like hasn't been looked at, and we need some time to actually do this the way we think is right. And they didn't get it, and so I think they were forced to do this action now with the hope that, you know, we can come back later with something.
Jack, I got a text message after this press release came out from a well-known Republican who said, if I'm Rick Snyder, I'm taking a trip to China for a year or two. Do you think he's got reason to be worried?
Well, I think he's got reason to be worried. That would be the big name that they would go after. I've been skeptical about the case from day one. I don't know how you get government officials for what arguably could be judgment calls on when you announce this, when I think it would be very difficult to do. But I think this is a case where keeping the possibility out there going with an ongoing case is the short-term goal, I think, at some point. And you do realize that, for instance, if they had not done this and if Lyons had just been acquitted, well, you still have that we did everything we could, that dang court just didn't, blah, blah, blah. You have that to come back with. And I think it's, in the long run, they will come up with somebody. The big name is Rick Snyder. My daughter lives in Maine. I talked to her yesterday. It was Father's Day. And one of the first things she said is, hey, I heard Rick Snyder's going to be on tried in the Flint water thing. This is in Maine. It gives you an idea of how this place to people who are a little bit outside of Michigan. But I think you have to have the effort shown, and I think the story continue. I am continue to be extremely skeptical about how you get a public official on something like this, though.
Plus you got to remember, when Bill Schuette was Attorney General and he was looking at the Capitol building and thinking about Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, they were in the midst of this investigation. You can't tell me that Bill Schuette and company didn't look over absolutely every possible way to get this to stick, either on Brian Kelly or Rick Snyder, as a way to defeat their political enemy at the time. I got to believe that almost everything Snyder has done or did has been gone over with a fine-tooth comb looking for something already.
I thought I heard the Republican Party told Schuette to back off on Snyder, though.
I doubt that.
I like where Jack's going on this, though, because I think that in the end, we're looking at a settlement of some sort, and that I think Nestle, Whitmer, et al. Are going to come out with some big settlement on the civil side to try and make Flint whole. That includes a bit of money, and maybe that will overshadow the criminal stuff, and the criminal stuff will fade away.
But think about the long-term effect of something like this. If somebody ends up doing jail time because they didn't give an alert on time or something like that, from then on, everybody's going to give an alert at the drop of a hat because they're going to be afraid of somebody coming back in court and saying you didn't do it soon enough. I think there's some real problems long-term with trying to hit somebody on what can be a leadership judgment call. And you can say, boy, you got that wrong and be mad about it. But I just don't know how a person in public office would react to knowing that, you know, I don't think this is good. This is going to make a whole lot of people upset for no reason. It's too early to do it. But wait a minute, I got a potential that somebody's going to sue me later.
Yeah. And that's where I think the intent comes from. And I don't know, Abby, I'm not an attorney, but from what I have heard in these cases, that they have to prove intent at some point, that they intended to hurt these people of Flint. I don't know how you do that.
Like I said, I think that the legal aspects of the criminal charges, I have always had questions about. Again, I'm not a legal expert. I share the concerns of the rest of the group. But politically, I mean, people don't understand mostly the difference between criminal and civil. And criminal sounds worse. What people hear is like criminal means they did something bad.
Right.
And they're held accountable. And I will also say that people's ideas about justice are, you know, they're very complicated, right? Like in a malpractice case against a doctor, like people will give a big settlement of millions of dollars based on the harm, not what the doctor did wrong, right? Mm-hmm. If a young mother dies, even if the doctor did everything right, the jury will want to give the family money. So I feel like it is one of those extremely emotional situations. Children were harmed. And so people just want something. And I think you might have a very good point. If there's a big settlement, a big civil settlement, that would be something that would, you know, draw the attention. And it doesn't actually help people in Flint to have someone sitting in prison. That doesn't do anything for people. But a massive settlement that could pay for years and years and years to help these kids that are going to be impacted by lead poisoning for the rest of their lives, that would be really meaningful.
We're going to have to keep an eye on that, figure out what's going to happen there. And we'll go ahead and go to the interview here with James Lawrence.
Joining me on the other end of the line is James Lowry, the state representative, now from Eureka Township in Montcalm County. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Kyle.
So we are, about 3 weeks now into your campaign for the 3rd Congressional District position against current incumbent Justin Amash. Tell our listeners what this has been like.
It's been great. It's been really exciting. A lot of momentum just basically right out of the gate that hasn't let up. It seems like every day there's a new thing coming our way and new supporters coming in from not only in the 3rd District but around the state of Michigan and even nationally. So it's been a really exciting campaign so far, and we plan to keep that momentum up all the way to August of 2020 and then November.
This past weekend, on Friday, there was something called a quash. Am I getting that right?
Squash. It was Squash Amash, yes.
Now, did you have anything to do with this?
I was there and, had a lot of supporters there. A lot of the people there were supporters of mine, but I don't know that it'd be fair to say I had anything to do with it.
Tell our listeners about what type of showing was there. How many people, what were they saying, how long were they there?
They were there for a couple hours. It was basically a grassroots effort outside of his office at the federal building in Grand Rapids. And it was a lot of former supporters of his that were basically just straight up angry at him for his record in Congress. And then I think the straw that broke the mule's back for him were these calls for impeachment and then threatening to run against President Trump is a libertarian, and to a lot of Republicans and Trump supporters, that clearly shows that, I mean, he's always been a libertarian and always campaigned that way. There's been some question of whether or not he was in the mainstream of the party. But at this point, if you're threatening to run against the president as a third party, you are a third party. You know, you're not really part of the mainstream of the party anymore. And that's why he's going to be defeated in August. And they're going to nominate me, you know, someone who's an actual Republican, someone who supports the president, who's pro-life, pro-jobs, pro-Second Amendment, and supports all of the issues that the party supports.
So we had a poll from Practical Political Consultants this past week that shows you with a 16 percentage point edge over Justin Amash in a hypothetical primary with just you two on the ballot. That's probably not going to be the case, probably be some others probably on the ballot. But what kind of feedback did you get after that poll came out?
So a couple things on that poll that's interesting. Like you said, it was just me versus him, which may change. You know, it may not. That's still too early to tell. But the poll actually included a lot of Democrats in it. And then in the poll, that's where his support was coming from primarily. And in a Republican primary, it's not uncommon for Democrats to vote in it, but not at the margin, including your poll. And if you looked at the crosstabs, we were actually up by 2-1 with the Republican voters, which is more likely to be the turnout, as you noted in your newscast. So I think the response has been, you know, kind of what you'd expect. People knew that we were running a strong campaign and that I'm a very strong candidate, but now there's some numbers to back that up from a third party instead of just, you know, our internal polling.
Your internal polling, does it have you doing better against Amash or worse against Amash?
Better. Better than that poll, but probably because, you know, ours doesn't include as many Democrats. And I think that one had almost a third Democrats, which is it basically never happened in a Republican primary in Michigan. So that's probably why ours was higher.
Some of the Twitter traffic that I've seen since we put that poll out included the comment that if Justin Amash does not run again or is in some other way not the nominee out of the 3rd Congressional District, that it could go to the Democrats. I wanted to get your response to that.
Yeah, that's just kind of some fear-mongering. I mean, I know he does have some crossover appeal, but I do as well. I mean, if you take a look at when I ran for state rep, it was a seat where, you know, my predecessor had to unseat a Democrat and then had a tough re-election battle in 12 and then basically had a free shot in 14, so he did well. But we really overperformed in 2016 and in 18 what the base is of the district. So I've got a track record of doing that, so I don't think that's something that's going to change for the third. But also, it is a strongly Republican district. The president won it by 14% in 16, and that was when I think he's even more popular now than he was then. So he's going to carry it by a strong margin, and I'm going to carry it by a strong margin in November.
The other thing that I wanted to bring up, and this is going to probably play out more in the primary, is where you are and where you represented in the state house. Your 70th House District and the 3rd Congressional District really only overlap in that Eureka Township there in Montcalm County, which is a tiny portion of the district. How do you make up for that, and how do you tell the folks in Grand Rapids, which pretty much makes up the plurality of the 3rd Congressional District, that you are one of them and you're not a carpetbagger?
Yeah, well, not a carpetbagger is really easy. Grew up in the district, born and raised. I was born in Grand Rapids, raised in Ionia, graduated from Ionia High School, got my MBA at Grand Valley, and I voted for Amash 3 times in 10, 12, and 14. So, yes, I lived just outside the district for like 3 or 4 years, but now we're back in. So this is my home area. You know, carpetbaggers typically when somebody moves from New York or California in and tries to win it. This isn't the case here. And the majority of the district is actually a rural area. Grand Rapids is obviously the heart of the district and is a crucial part of it. But, you know, the primary voters and even in the general, the majority of them comes from outside of Grand Rapids, not in. I know Grand Rapids typically thinks of itself as the kingmaker in the district, but especially if you have a crowded primary or whatever the case is, the response to our campaign has been very positive. It's basically a non-issue. It'll continue to be a non-issue. And I'll go back to your poll even. One of the interesting points in that was people who had lived in the district for 20 years or more was the demographic that I was doing the best with, not the worst. So if you looked at that we were up well over 2-1 with those voters. So what that shows is what our polling shows too. The voters really don't care about this issue. This isn't a race about who lives in Grand Rapids or who lives in Greenville or who grew up in Ionia. It's a national race. It's about the president. It's about being conservative. It's about having a pro-life, pro-jobs, pro-Second Amendment voting record, and they're just not going to care about those other factors.
The other question that's bound to come up is the DeVos family, which is a huge part of the West Michigan area, not only financially, but politically as well. Have you been in communications with anybody from the DeVos family about what they're going to do in this primary?
Absolutely, we have. You know, as you know, I was gearing up to run well before these impeachment comments, and we had reached out and had a couple of meetings with members of the DeVos' political operation. And I think you're absolutely right. I think they'll be influential in it. I mean, Betsy DeVos is obviously part of the Trump cabinet, and they're very likely to go with the pro-Trump candidate. I think there's some perception out there that, you know, they'll maybe go with, you know, the Grand Rapids powers that be, but they're going to be with Trump because they support President Trump just like I do. So they're going to be where he's at.
So how do you convince them that you're the person, that you're the one who's going to defeat Justin Amash, and you're the person who should be representing the 3rd Congressional District, and just not the DeVos's, but the other moneyed interests in Grand Rapids?
I think it's a pretty easy case to make, to be honest with you. I mean, if you take a look at my track record in the State House, and even as, you know, all my prior work experience, it's been a very pro-West Michigan record. You know, if you look at the West Michigan Policy Forum, which the DeVos's and certainly the other big donors in the area care a lot about, if you look at their agenda from last session, they had basically 10 priority items, and there were 4 of which that I was the lead sponsor on the package, and those 4 items were things that had never gotten solved before in the past, and we found a way to get it done. So, and I did that because I believed in those issues and because there's something that I cared about. So we just have a lot in common, and I think that hopefully they're going to appreciate the fact that we have a lot in common and that I'm able to actually get things done, whereas Amash, as I've noted, hasn't gotten anything done in Congress in 10 years. So you may have some other candidates get into the race. I don't think there's going to be anybody else with a demonstrable track record of actually, you know, voting for the issues that West Michigan cares about and certainly that constituency cares about and being able to get them done. So that's our pitch. I think, you know, in the long run, they'll probably get on board. I know it's a little bit early, but we're excited about it.
I think I read somewhere that Steve Mitchell, who's one of your consultants, believes that this is going to be a $1 million race. Do you concur with that and believe that you can raise that kind of money?
Absolutely, I believe we can raise that kind of money. And he's working with our campaign. I believe we've made those statements in the past. If you look at the first, whatever it's been now, 20, 25 days, I mean, we're going to be releasing our fundraising totals, you know, for the July quarterly filing. And I think people are going to be very impressed with the amount we've already brought in for just the first 40 days. And I don't see that momentum tapering off at all. I think if anything, it's building. You know, people are getting more and more excited about it once they learn more about me, more about my track record, more about my voting record, and more about my support for the president.
And you're getting support not just in the 3rd Congressional District, but my understanding is you're getting support from across the country.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's why I made the statement yesterday. You know, I think that the Detroit News, that it's a national race already. We're bringing in money from not only all over the 3rd District, all over the state of Michigan, and certainly nationally. There's people, as we're talking right now, sending us donations because they really want me to win. They want me to win this race. They want me to unseat Justin Amash, and they want me to go to Congress.
And then as part of your pitch, and I know that you're going to be going to D.C. at some point, you're going to be talking to folks out there. And how do you tell them that, you know, you really don't want to back anybody else because we don't want to split the pie up and create a situation where you have Justin Amash back?
And that's an easy pitch to make. I think it's something that most people out there, these are very politically savvy individuals, and we are going out there this coming week. They already know that. You know, that's not really a pitch I have to make. They know that we, you know, the more people you get in, the more it breaks it up. But it's not just about that issue. It's about me specifically. You know, it's a lot easier to back somebody with an actual track record of working in a legislative process and of winning elections. If you have some unknown entity, you know, a third person that gets in who's completely unproven, no voting record, no political track record, it's very difficult for people to get behind that because you don't know what you're getting. They could say all the right things in the campaign like Amash did and then get down there and be not a team player at all and isolate and marginalize themselves. They don't want to watch that movie over again. We've all seen it before. I've been through it. As you know, I was a big Amash supporter and we're very disenchanted now, and I don't think people in D.C. or in the district want to go through that again, and I think that's why that you're seeing a lot of consolidation behind our candidacy.
One more question, and you kind of touched on it earlier in the interview, but 2010, when Amash won the district basically through that split primary, Bill Hardiman, I remember, was in it. Steve Heacock was in that.
And there was a couple other candidates, too, Buck for Bob and Louise Johnson, I think.
And you supported Amash in that 210 primary.
I did. Yep. Absolutely. A lot of people did. You know, it's amazing the number of people that, you know, I had a fundraiser in Grand Rapids with some grassroots supporters the other night. And I would say 70 to 80% of the people in the room had donated to and supported Amash, just like I had. So I think I'm actually a good messenger in that regard, and that, you know, I can talk to those voters about how he's failed us and why he's disappointing. And it's a message that has a lot of credibility.
If you had to put odds on it, the chances he runs for president, would you put it 50-50?
No, I'd put it lower than that. Maybe I'm in the minority on this. I know a lot of people think that he's going to run for president, but, you know, I'm on the ground in the district, and I was at his town hall for the whole thing, and I've been reading, obviously, his media clips, just like I'm sure he's reading mine. And it seems like he wants to leave the door and the speculation open on that, but most of what he's doing seems to indicate that he wants to run again. I know he said in the Detroit News a couple of days ago that he's, quote, absolutely 100% confident that he'll be reelected or something to that effect. And he sure felt like a candidate for Congress to me at his town hall. So I would put it much lower than 50-50, but of course, like anybody, I could be wrong.
All right. Well, we'll see how it goes. James Lauer, state representative out of Eureka Township in Montcalm County. Thanks for taking some time and talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Kyle.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Representative Lauer, Abby Clark for coming in, Jacob, Jack, and John, the three J's. And guys, the magical electrical tape somehow managed to stay on this tape recorder for 22 minutes after three fits and starts.
Well, we already talked about the tape, and Kyle, I just wanted to say that you forgot to do something.
What's that?
Didn't someone suggest that we should introduce ourselves at the beginning? So no
oh,
one,
yeah, we did. Yeah.
Now no one knows who's talking. Well they know that Abby.
Yeah, they know. Yeah, they
so
know.
Like 60 Minutes sure. Style. This is John Roering.
Well, he usually says someone's name before he puts the microphone in their direction. Also, you guys all have names that are easy to confuse with each other if it's just the first name.
That is true. We got the three J's.
Yeah, yeah. That's a little tricky.
You mean I have to remember my name?
I know, that's a big ask, Jack, but that's a decent idea. What if we did it 60 Minutes style?
Good.
Okay, so let's pretend we're doing 60 Minutes. Okay. I'm Kyle Malin.
I'm John Roering.
This is Jack Spencer.
And I'm Jacob Kinsler.
Who did the best?
I thought everyone was great.
Oh, come on. I like John.
Yeah, that was very 60 Minutes. I thought that was the most 60 Minutes.
All right, now you've listened to the whole podcast, so just rewind it. Wait, this is digital. Never mind. Go back to the beginning, and now you'll know who was speaking the whole time.
Maybe I'm going to have to do the podcast now like that.
Yeah, why not?
Oh, yeah, we could.
You can just put that into the beginning. Just use those clips every time.
Tick, 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 tick.
I think you should contact 3M, and you should tell them, look, we have already mentioned this, so if you give... Send us some tape that will work, and we will give you a plug that how great your tape will.
Give us that PFAS tape.
They've already gotten some coverage. This is their first positive coverage.
There you go. Let's make it stick.
Nice. All right. Thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this great podcast. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.